Welcome to the Child Care Business Podcast, brought to you by ProCare Solutions. This podcast is all about giving child care, preschool, daycare, after school, and other early education professionals a fun and upbeat way to learn about strategies and inspiration you can use to thrive. You'll hear from a variety of childcare thought leaders, including educators, owners, and industry experts on ways to innovate to meet the needs of the children you serve. From practical tips for managing operations to uplifting stories of transformation and triumph, this podcast will be chock full of insights you can use to fully realize the potential of your childcare business. Let's jump in.
Welcome, everybody, to the Child Care Business Podcast. Excited to have everybody here with us again today. And, as always, we're always trying to scour the industry and find guests that we think can deliver a lot of value and insights for our audience. And certainly today is no exception. I'm actually looking really forward to today's guest and the interview. Want to talk to you or actually introduce everybody to Louise Stoney. Many of you might recognize that name if you're familiar and been a part of our industry for any length of time. The more that I'm in our space, the more I hear about Louise and her group and all the things that they're doing. Just really quick, by way of a quick introduction, Louise is an independent consultant specializing in early care and education, finance and policy. And she's the co-founder of both Opportunities Exchange and the Alliance for Early Childhood Finance. Louise has worked with the state and local governments, foundations, ECE providers, industry intermediaries, research and advocacy groups for over, over the course of many years and in over 40 states. Public and private organizations have sought Louise's expertise to help craft new finance and policy options, as well as write issue briefs on challenging topics. She's helped model ECE program costs, revise subsidy policy and rate setting strategies. She revisits QRIS standards and procedures. She crafts new approaches to contracting and voucher management and a lot more. So Louise holds a master's degree in social work from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. So everybody, and everybody would be me at this point because it's a podcast, giving you a warm welcome. Louise, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for inviting me, Ryan.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. So Louise, I'm going to start with this question just so we can, maybe introduce the audience a little bit to the concept of shared services. Can you talk a little bit about the shared services model and define what that is?
Yeah. So actually I'm going to go back just a little bit to give people some context. So I've been in this field for well over 35 years, and I started in this field on the policy and finance side. I used to work for the state legislature, and I sort of came out really trying to, and my goal was to increase money for the field. And I got really good at that. I could open up lots of spigots, a bunch of different funding streams, but I could never make it simple. It's never going to be simple, tapping all these different funding streams, dealing with all the accountability, managing the money. And that really led. And then I started realizing, like, our childcare businesses are so small. You've got one individual that's responsible for everything, including this really complex finance that is super important. And so I kind of set myself on a course of saying, wait a minute, it's no point in me raising more money for childcare if we're not actually getting that money into the pockets of the providers that are running the programs. So that led me to really sort of think and look under the hood, what could we do? And at the time I was working with an economist at Cornell University who was a specialist in sort of economic development. And I started looking at other industries and thinking about industry clusters. And that really led me to realize that in many, many industries, the members of the industry have bonded together to invest in technology or invest in infrastructure. I mean, think about it. When you drive up to a gas pump and you put a credit card into right? Why is that possible? That's possible because the banks collaborated on a system for money to flow. And that collaboration really led to a whole host of business opportunities for a whole host of businesses, right? And you can name all sorts of examples of this. The airline industry, where you make reservations, the hotel, right? But childcare had not capitalized on this at all. We just weren't really thinking about these strategies. We were still operating in isolation small businesses. So that really led me to sort of say, hey, wait a minute, we need to create strategies for this sector to be able to come together to share the investment in resources, to share staff, to share technology. And so that was sort of the birth of the shared services movement in my head. And like anything, everything I know that matters, I learned in the School of Hard Knocks. So we just learned this by doing it. We try this. Would it work? No, let's evaluate it. Let's try something else. And that really led us, you know, a step by step by step. And we're constantly learning, constantly changing, you know, constantly trying to figure out how do we really deliver value to providers.
Yeah. And I want to touch a little bit on a few things that you just stated there. And I want to also spend some time talking, because I think even over the last 18 months, like everything that's been going on in our country and in our society, and certainly in our industry, is shown even a brighter light on a lot of the things that you guys are working on and kind of focused your energy on. But when you were working, so early days, when you were working at the state legislature level and you were working to get funding for childcare, can you describe like what did that entail? Are you talking about subsidy dollars for centers providing care to low-income families? Was it grants? Like, what did that all involve when you were working on trying to find money?
It was anything. I mean, I used to joke and say to people, you give me a funding stream and I'll figure out how to finance childcare. So, I mean, honestly, there's so many ways that you can tap so many different funding streams, but it requires it requires really good record keeping, you know, and business acumen on the part of the provider so that they actually know how to present themselves and tap the money. And then it does require some creative thinking about how you can pull dollars down. But the reality is there are always many opportunities. So yes, subsidy dollars is the lifeblood, but by far not the only funding stream that early childhood programs can tap.
And then what you were finding, and I think a lot of this still exists today, is there's funding out there, there's resources available, but they weren't getting into the hands of the actual individual owners. What are the constraints that cause that? Like, meaning, is it because there's not awareness from a provider on how and where to go find those funds? Is it because there's too much bureaucracy to get the money into their hands? Can you elaborate on some of the constraints?
Well, those are two issues that you just made. Yes, those are true. But I think a bigger issue is providers simply don't have systems in place to be able to tap and manage even money that is already there in front of them. I'll give you a concrete example. We worked with a project in Atlanta, Georgia, that helped a cohort of about two dozen childcare programs, mostly centers, but a few homes, get automated. And they tracked over the course of the year outcomes. These providers, when they first started the project, they estimated that on average, the programs had about $50,000 of uncollected revenue. Revenue they could have collected, they were not collected. We call that bad debt. And by the end of the project, they'd gotten that down to $800 per program in 1 year, simply by getting them all using an automated system, which, by the way, happened to be ProCare, by getting them to maximize the use of that automated system, to fully understand. They also had a coach. They had an enterprise version, so the coach could really go in and take a look at their metrics, help them understand when she saw they had a problem, help them solve that problem. And let me be clear, the money that they were leaving on the table was a combination of parent fees that they weren't collecting because they hadn't automated transactions and they weren't up to date. Every day that you don't collect money from a parent, it decreases your ability to ever collect that money. So you got to really be on top of collections. Secondly, there was a lot of money from government that was not collected because they didn't have systems in place to reconcile what government owed them with what they actually got paid. They didn't catch errors. Usually with government, you have like maybe 60 days to catch an error. You don't catch it within that 60 days. Sorry, Charlie, you lose the money. So just by instituting procedures like that, helping the providers to automate them, to make them simple, to have a coach that helped them do it, huge, huge difference in the finances for these programs.
Yeah, I like how you said that. It's not just like all these untapped sources of revenue. It's actually taking the revenue that's already available to you and the customers that you're working with and making sure that that cash flow is consistent, is dialed, that you're not chasing money, reducing bad debt. Can you, just to give our audience an idea, because you referenced this user story or this, you know, case study in Atlanta, Can you take even a one step back in terms of that particular like case study? How did that start? Like, meaning when we talk about trying to find that group of providers and identify who they are and organize that shared service environment to really enable them with the coach and those resources, how does your organization identify the hub or, you know, the organization that's going to support that? And then how do you actually, you know, message that to a community of providers to actually build a story like you just shared that benefits those local providers? How did that start? What does that look like?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So I could tell you the story of this one particular alliance, but it would be idiosyncratic. In other words, they're all different. So let me just say that particular alliance was started and led by a visionary child care resource and referral organization.
Okay.
But we have shared service alliances that are led by community foundations, that are led by large child care centers that have an altruistic, mission-driven perspective, by nonprofit organizations that might sponsor a staffed family child care network. We have the AEYCs. We have some led by AEYCs. So there is no particular organization that is the right place. Here's what matters. What you're looking for is a hub organization, someone who's willing to be your back office or backbone that is mission driven. In other words, they are willing to do the job of leading centralized administration and supporting your participating providers at cost. They're not taking any profit. They're simply covering their cost to do it so that they can return back to the providers more money. Because I'll be really honest. At Opportunities Exchange, we have a very strong and very clear mission. And we believe that every child care director deserves an administrative team. We believe that every child deserves a reflective teacher. And we believe that every teacher deserves reflective supervision. So we want those outcomes. And that means we've got to shift dollars from administration into classrooms, so that teachers are paid more, they get better wages, and so that administrators can actually get away from their desk and into classrooms, working with teachers, not struggling with paperwork all the time. So we're very clear that we really want to do this in an environment that is focused on serving children and serving children with high needs.
Yeah, I love that. And so in terms of, like you said, every single shared service, it looks different, starts differently. Some of these are organic, but it always starts with an organization, if I heard you correctly, Louise, that says, hey, we're a mission-driven organization in XYZ city, and we want to be the administrative backbone for this initiative because we believe in the outcomes that it can deliver for basically, you know, at the end of the day, families and students in our community. So they sign up and they say, we want to do this. There's not a financial incentive for them. It's all about their mission, aligning with their mission. But then how does that work? Is there funding that comes into that organization, like government funding that they can then use to go provide incentives for providers in addition to the outcomes that they believe they can deliver? Right. Are there financial incentives? Is that accurate?
So the answer is sometimes. Okay. So let me back up and say that Opportunities Exchange is essentially a nonprofit consulting firm. So our goal is to transform the business of early care and education. And we do that primarily through shared services. So we are actually out there to help make this happen. And most of the time we work with people who come to us, people who read our stuff and say, oh, I love this idea. I want to make it happen. And typically what happens is we'll get a phone call from an organization that wants to be a hub, and they have maybe a kernel of funding, or they have a small startup grant. They got an idea and they got a few pieces, right? And we basically say, great, let's help you get started. And we help them start putting those pieces together. What could you do now with the funding that you have now? How do you build on that funding? What are other sources? So we do that. Now, let me also say that we understand that early care and education is a very regulated industry. And in order for things to be successful, you have to also work with public policy. So at the same time as we are working with organizations that are working on launching shared services, we are also working with state child care administrators and people inside the Beltway to educate them about early care and education business and shared services and innovation. And so that they're primed too, to really think differently about the funding that they make available. So, and we're also working with vendors like ProCare and others, right, to help them understand how does this work all fit together and what would be important things for them to do. So we're constantly sort of working on this larger ecosystem alongside as working with the programs themselves. Right now in COVID, and I mean COVID recovery, there's lots of potential funding streams that could be used to support shared services. And so, and again, not they're different in every state, sometimes in every city. And we just are really helping people think through, here's what you're trying to accomplish. Let's think about how you, what your business plan is for that. And now let's look at what are the different funding streams you might tap.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is it fair to say, I mean, just going to something you mentioned about the advocacy you do at the state level across the country, you know, we've heard a lot about government funding, you know, through COVID relief coming down to the state level where, you know, look, we've earmarked funds for ECE and we've heard from states saying, hey, we have these funds, but we're not sure how to go administer them and how to go deliver them in the most impactful way. Two questions. A, is that an accurate statement from what you guys are seeing and hearing? And then B, is that something that you guys are working with states on to help them understand how to get those dollars flowing into the proper channels?
So yes and no. So yes, I think that's a pretty accurate description. And we are working with some states. I mean, we don't insert ourselves in places where we're not wanted. We're not requested. So it's not like we're out there sort of saying, hey, states, listen to us. And we're like, you know, we're not a national organization in that way, you know, that sort of puts out. We basically really respond to folks where there seems to be a readiness for change, where they reach out and say, hey, we really want to think about things differently. And we try to educate them. We try to get them to really understand, here's the challenges. Here's what you need to understand in order to be effective. So let me go right to COVID dollars. So while it is true that on some level states don't know how to spend money, it's also true that states know that 90% of their money needs to go out to providers. And so they're in the process of developing some of them have already developed application process where providers can apply for those relief funds. At the same time, they are also reading the federal guidance, which says these are the things providers are allowed to spend the money on. These are the rules for how we're going to handle accountability. And they're, quite frankly, you know, skating on thin ice because, you know, we've never really asked for this level of record keeping from providers. The whole way we're going to track accountability is unclear. And so my feeling is the provider community needs to be prepared. Because the last thing we need is for there suddenly to be an audit and, oh my, you know, you don't have the records, right? Or right. For there to be a provider who uses the money inappropriately, the press gets a hold of it. Suddenly there's this big bag story and it hurts everybody. Sure. So we believe that it's really important, not just for state health care administrators to think about what investments they need to make, but also for providers to be prepared. That's why we are unapologetically and boldly pushing child care management software. We believe that it is the roads and bridges of recovery. right now we get child care providers that are literally driving on dirt roads, if there's even a road. And we need to pave those roads and then start building connectors so that we can actually have the information, the record keeping, the accountability that we need to have these dollars flow in a way that everyone is comfortable they're spent in the right way. And that's why child care management software is so important.
Yeah. And we are, I mean, you and I have talked a lot over the years. I know we've worked together on this topic and this conversation and the importance of, you know, automation and the proper record keeping tools. Are you and your team getting a sense that because of some of these changes over the last year and a half, and because of some of the things you just mentioned about how funds are becoming available, has it changed at all the reception that you're receiving from providers and their awareness of how important that is, like digitizing
their business? Absolutely. Yeah. We're getting a lot more interest from providers. We're getting a lot more interest from government. We're getting a lot more willingness on the part of government to pay for subscriptions to child care management software. And I just want to underscore this and say this loud and clear to your audience. You can use your COVID dollars on purchasing software. Even if it doesn't say it in the list, it is an allowable expense.
Yeah, and so say that again one more time. We'll repeat that one. Yeah.
You can use your COVID dollars. So we are actually encouraging states to message that to providers. In fact, to go even further and actually purchase, you know, negotiate both discounts, purchase the software, make it available easily. There's lots of different ways states are doing that. Some states are, you know, working on big buys. Some states are just creating a list of approved software and saying, here, choose one of these softwares. We'll help you pay for it. The other thing that we're working on that's super important for providers is we are also working on what we call the early care and education technology ecosystem. And the idea is we know that it's entirely possible now in a cloud-based environment to link all these systems together. So that if you're a childcare provider and you're using an automated childcare management system and you check in a child electronically, you should be able to just bill subsidy with that same check-in. In other words, you shouldn't have to do a separate swipe card. You shouldn't have to go key in separate data. You shouldn't have to, God forbid, in some states, create a separate paper form with a separate wet signature, right? All of that is old school. Yep. And we are totally in a space to be able to transform the sector so that it will be easy when we're having more and more families check in using CR codes. That same CR code could drive your subsidy payment. Now, I'm going to do a commercial here. Only if you're using ProCare Connect.
There you go.
The old desktop version, convert to ProCare Connect if you want to get into the 20th century. So, yes, and any, you know, our childcare management systems are, but we're working very hard to get states to be open to this concept of APIs, to this concept of one-stop shopping for subsidy management so that there's not all this separate paperwork, which will make it so much easier for providers to get the money they're owed and to accept children who are receiving public subsidy.
Yeah. Well, and the other piece of that, I mean, you're right. We're lots of conversations happening because in the past, states have been really separate from what individual providers are doing in terms of running their business. And they've had their own set of process and policies. And that's where you're, hey, I've captured my attendance electronically, but now I got to go push it out manually into a separate system. So there's that conversation. But the other piece that's really interesting that'll be fun to see how, you know, things continue to evolve is that conversation about how that opens up the awareness around availability incentives.
Oh, yes. I mean,
you know, now we can feed to the state a family that's looking for care. We know where there's available spots in their community, and we help not only families find spots, but then that drives, you know, FTEs and enrollments at the center level so that, you know, centers can actually have better access to filling open spots, right? Like that's part of this conversation as
100% part of this conversation. I talked about only one small piece of the early care and education ecosystem, and that is the subsidy. But no, another big piece is linking childcare management systems to the childcare search function so that you're getting real-time live data on availability and you're getting it easily without the provider having to log into another portal and enter more data. You're literally able to pull it out of the childcare management system. Absolutely. That's a big piece of it. And there's more. I mean, we also believe there's huge advances that can happen on the pedagogical side around child assessment data, a lot of the requirements for quality rating systems, for accreditation systems. There's absolutely no reason that professional development registries is another one. We can connect all these systems electronically, which will save childcare programs huge amounts of time and really allow them to focus their energy in the classroom with kids and not with all this paperwork.
Yeah, which when you get down to the heart of it, Louise, I mean, I know there's a lot of alignment for, you know, companies like ourselves and what you guys are doing that at the end of the day, it gets down to that. It's all about outcomes for these children and providing the absolute best quality product in that space. And so, you know, everything we're talking about, and I do think I don't know if silver lining, in fact, I'm sure it's not the right term to use about COVID, but in terms of like, providing some momentum to these topics and pushing technology forward and figuring out how things can be leveraged to better impact, you know, resources for providers. I think it has created a lot of momentum for the things you guys have been talking about for years, certainly what we've been doing for many years. Can you talk, I want to ask you too about a concept that I know is like really central to what you guys do in terms of supporting providers, which is the iron triangle. Like the iron triangle, I think is something like that people maybe have heard that term. People are maybe hearing it more. I know, you know, we met years ago at a conference in Florida. I think it was maybe a childcare success conference, or maybe it was NACI. And we were talking about some demographics around millennials and how that was impacting the industry. But that's when, you know, you first talked to me about the concept of the iron triangle. And then ever since then, I just hear about it more and more. Can you speak to what the iron triangle is and maybe anything around that in terms of why it's important for providers to be aware of?
So I've spent many years working on early care and education finance. I've looked at very complicated Excel spreadsheets. I've done all sorts of cost modeling. If I had to boil everything I know into one simple picture, it's the iron triangle. The three most important things you have to do to run a successful childcare business is you got to be fully enrolled. Every seat, every classroom that you're staffed to serve. I'm not talking about licensed capacity. I'm talking about staffed capacity. So enrollment based on staffed capacity needs to be full. Number two, you have to collect every dime you're owed. So full fee collection. So full enrollment, full fee collection. And then the third one is that your revenue covers your cost, which means that you're setting your tuition at a price that covers your cost. You understand your unit cost. You know what your cost per child is, which is going to be different based on the age of the child. And then you're understanding whether your tuition is covering it. And if it's not, you have a plan in place to fill that gap. You have a third party funding, or you've readjusted your rates or whatever. So full enrollment, full fee collection, and revenue that covers your cost. That's the iron triangle. If you can just track those three things, track your enrollment. And the providers that we work with are tracking it every week, every classroom. That's a huge issue for them. Number two, they're tracking full fee collection. I told you, every day that you don't collect is a day you're less likely to collect. So they're on top of that every week, looking at it really closely. And then thirdly, they all know what their cost per child is, which is not simple. That requires real record keeping. You got to use a software to be able to really calculate your expenses and then sort your expenses by classroom. We have tools on our website to help providers do that. But once you know what it is, then you can benchmark, you know, is your tuition meeting your cost? If not, what's your gap? And that really helps you make smarter business decisions. So it's three key metrics that really can make a big difference. And childcare management software can absolutely help every single one of those three things. It makes it a lot easier when you have an automated system. You can run a report on each leg of the iron triangle.
Yeah, it's almost impossible. I mean, I wouldn't say impossible, but obviously to try to get to those metrics and really understand your business without the proper tools.
Correct.
You know, I know this, it's not a plug for ProCare, but just the concept of automating your business without those tools in place, it becomes really difficult to actually stay on top of those things that you mentioned. And we'll put in our show notes. And at the end, I want to give you an opportunity to share where, you know, listeners can find those resources about, you know, some of those tools you have and calculators on figuring out your cost per student. Is that a pretty common issue that you guys see when you actually get into the weeds of centers, that their tuition isn't priced properly based on, you know, their cost per student? Is that common?
It's very common. In fact, I'll be honest with you, Ryan. It is common for childcare programs to not have data on any of the iron triangle. There are many programs that they're not tracking their enrollment. They're not tracking their fee collection, and they're not tracking. They don't understand their unit cost. And again, I don't mean this as a criticism. This is not intentional. They're sort of doing it by the seat of their pants, or they're doing it by their hunch. I can't tell you how often I work with programs that say, oh, we're full. And then I say, well, let's run the numbers. Let's look at your data. And we see, wait a minute, you're not full. Like there was a whole month when this seat wasn't filled. And this class, you're waiting for this child to age up. So that's 6 months that you didn't have that. Now, I'm not saying, I understand you make those business decisions, but it's important to realize what they mean in terms of your finances and to really be on top of it.
I thought I was full. I thought my FTEs were at 100%, but they weren't. And so, you know, those are two different things for sure. Yeah, that's really insightful. Do you like coming out of, you know, some of the changes from COVID, Louise, and some of the things that you guys are hearing and seeing? Because I know one of the things that we've seen is, you know, some of the ratio numbers have started to change based on like spacing issues and those types of things. Has that changed the model at all? Do you envision that being an ongoing change or temporary, if so?
I have to say, honestly, there might have been some temporary changes in ratios, but most of it has gone back to what it was before. So I don't think that's the real issue. I think what we are seeing in COVID, and I do think it's likely to be an ongoing challenge, we are seeing much lower enrollment in programs. We're seeing programs really struggle to be full. A lot of this is that families have changed. Many families are not working from home. Has dramatically increased. And I think we're not going to go back, guys. I mean, I think that there will be some returning to the office, but in many ways, maybe a few days a week. I think parent demand is going to change a lot in terms of hours of care, in terms of types of care. And I think programs have to be prepared to deal with that, which means that they've got to really have good metrics so they can reflect on what's going on and be prepared to pivot. So that's number one. I think the second thing that's happened in COVID that's been dramatic is staffing. Yeah. Everybody is struggling to find staff. And not just early childhood, by the way. It is all across the board, every employer. And so what I'm hearing increasingly from the folks that are engaged in shared services is they are having to significantly boost wages. They're having to really step up to the plate and start providing benefits. Figuring out ways. And the benefits piece is great because you actually can leverage the Affordable Care Act. So that's pretty cool. You can do benefits now in a way that's actually affordable. But anyway, we're seeing programs really stepping into needing to increase wages. Well, the only way you're going to be able to increase wages is to, where's the money going to come from? You've got to shift dollars. You got to free up dollars from administration by working smarter, by maximizing automation so that you can boost wages in classrooms. It's the only way. And I think we're in for a real sea change. I don't know if you read the New York Times, but there was a fascinating article this weekend about restaurants, right? And restaurants are changing. They talked about innovative restaurants that are like moving away from tipping and actually paying workers wages. And quotes was interesting. I actually underscored quotes from those owners of the restaurants saying, I had to get really smart about running my business if I was going to increase wages. And I didn't have any choice because I have to increase wages. I had to really change my business model and work differently if I was going to create a positive work environment for my staff. So I think we're in a new day for early childhood program operators. And I think they're going to have to really rethink and really retool. And technology is a key part of that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. I thought you were going to reference an article over the weekend too that I read. I think it was the Washington Post actually, which is talking about our industry and this topic of like how many workers are leaving the industry because of the pain. We've heard this. I mean, I think if we went back and listened to all of our episodes as we talked to leaders in our space, like that is the theme right now in our industry, is because of the low pay. And pay isn't always everything, but you know, because of, you know, some of those factors, we're just seeing a lot of teachers leave the industry. And so to your point, you know, there's two ways to offset that. I've got to take dollars from other places in my business to put into those staff wages, or I have to increase revenues, or a combination of both. And there's a formula that all comes back to that, like you said, that iron triangle to be able to support that.
You know, another thing I want to put into the thinking cap is that you said it's not just wages, and I agree. It's also working conditions.
Yeah.
And so I also think that the field is going to be challenged to rethink the notion that a teacher is in a classroom all day, every day. That's a really high stress burnout job. And there may be ways for us to also rethink roles and responsibilities in programs, and maybe even rethink scheduling. We have workers that maybe work part-time or reschedule classrooms. And again, scheduling software, being able to use the data inside automated systems that actually, like you can run a report out of ProCare that tells you every hour of the day, What are my ratios? What's my staffing in each classroom? And you can begin to analyze, wait a minute, are there times of the day where I could restructure classrooms? Are there different ways that I can rethink scheduling teachers? So I just think that the higher order management thinking that's going to be required of directors going forward in this new world is going to be very challenging, and they need to be undergirded with really smart automation.
Yeah, I mean, it's really starting to think not just where we are right now, Louise, but thinking outside the box, 3, 6, 9, 12 months from now, like what is the landscape going to look like? And as a provider, being in front of that and innovating and being willing to let go of some of the long held practices of this is how we've always done it. Because I agree, like what we see in here is there's been a shift. And I think a lot of that can end up being really positive. I think the business itself, the financial model for schools can actually be strengthened moving forward, but it is going to look different to your point in terms of being able to get to that spot where, you know, margins are increasing. And as a business owner, you're mission driven in childcare, but it's also a financially sustainable model for you, which, you know, to your point earlier, you know, I think in the past you've seen a lot of providers who have, I love kids. This is my passion and that's why I do it. But now really to be able to strive and thrive in this industry, you got to have a financial business model. And that's, you know, a lot of what you guys are doing. How can people, I know we were talking before we came on the air. I want to be real sensitive to time because you're rolling right into the next meeting, as am I. If people out there in the industry want to learn more about, you know, some of the benefits of shared services or connect with your organization, and I mentioned this a few minutes ago, can you share some resources or places where people can find out more about you guys and reach out to you to connect?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. If you go to opex.org, OPPEX.org, that's our website. And you can, what I would suggest is sign up for our mailing list. We send out e-newsletters, you know, periodically that, and we typically focus our e-newsletter on one or two ideas. So we know people are busy and we're just trying to pepper you with a few new things to think about. But on our website are our toolkits for starting shared service alliances, for staff family chapter networks. There are financial management toolkits. There's just a boatload of stuff, and everything we have, download it, use it. You know, we're not like, you know, we don't sell it. That's not our business. We want you to use whatever's there and to feel free using whatever's there.
Excellent. And you guys also do now, I mean, you've kind of grown to a spot where you're also doing conferences, right? Like you guys have an annual conference. I think maybe there's been.
We have a national conference that we hold every 2 years. Okay. And this year, actually, we were supposed to have our conference next week in Austin, but we had to postpone because of COVID. So it is actually postponed till April 18th to 20th in Austin, Texas. And there's information on that at the website as well.
Excellent. And maybe what we'll do, Louise, I mean, it'll be a fun ongoing conversation. I know we end up running in some of the same circles, obviously, and working with OPEX quite a bit. But maybe right before or right after that national conference, maybe we'll have a session too, and just get a, you know, lay of the land and any changes that have happened over the last 6 months or so, and maybe promote some of the things that people can find at your conference for those who might want to attend.
Yeah. The other thing too, I want to say is that when we postponed the conference, we felt really badly because a lot of people had already signed up and paid. And so what we did was we agreed to do once a month between now and the conference, we're going to do a webinar, pulling out some of the topics we were going to do at the conference. But that webinar is only for people who have registered and paid for the conference. So there's a reason to go to our website and sign up now, because you will actually get access to monthly webinars leading up to the conference. And then you'll also get the chance to come to the conference, both either in person or virtually next year.
Yeah. And I, you know, just for somebody who's been to a bunch of the industry conferences over the years, I don't know if it was your last one, but the one that was in Detroit that I was at, I mean, really well run, extremely valuable content. There was a lot of, like, I always love when there's, you know, peer information. A lot of providers that were there were sharing their experience and how a shared service has impacted their operation. So I think there's, you know, not just industry experts, so to speak. And I can't remember. I don't think there was a vendor role, but maybe. But it's really a lot.
There will be this year. Unlike other conferences, to be a vendor at our conference is by invitation only. So it's a very small number of vendors that we know have value for the shared services world. And so it's not like overwhelming. It's a small amount of vendors. And our goal is to really help people have deep conversations with vendors and go into workshops so they understand, oh, let me see, here's how so-and-so is using it. Now let me go out and talk to the company and see if I can figure out whether that would be of value to me. So we're very intentional about vendors at our company.
Excellent. And any insight just in terms of like webinars between now and then the conference itself, any idea on some of the content that will be in those webinars? Is it all going to circle around the topics we've talked about today for the most part?
Like pretty much. Yeah. There'll be webinars on things like, you know, the technology ecosystem and a lot of stuff on childcare management software and different ways it's been used. A number of workshops on childcare on shared services startups. And basically different folks case studying their work. We'll have some workshops on healthcare and how to actually get access to healthcare. I'm just going from by memory. There's probably other stuff that I've forgotten. And then it's also just a great, it's, you know, we leave a lot of time for peer interaction. We believe that people learn as much from their peers as they do from us. And yeah. So we really want to encourage that kind of interaction.
Yep. And that's what I observed when I was there. So yeah, great stuff. I'll tell you what, I'm going to, you know, in terms of giving you a couple of minutes before rolling into the next meeting, I know how that goes. I want to really thank you for the time, Louise. I've been looking forward to this session since I saw it on my calendar and certainly didn't disappoint. So, you know, again, anybody who wants to find out more about kind of this topic, shared services, best place to go is opex.org. That's OPPEX.org. A lot of content there. And, wish you guys nothing but the best, Louise. Look forward to next time we have a chance to talk.
Okay, great. Take care.
All right. Bye. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Childcare Business Podcast. To get more insights on ways to succeed in your childcare business, make sure to hit subscribe in your podcast app so you never miss an episode. And if you want even more childcare business tips, tricks, and strategies, head over to our resource center at procaresoftware.com. Until next time.